Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading from Canto 10, Chapter 43, Text 2. Ranga Dwaram Samasadhya. Ranga Dwaram Samasadhya. Tasmin Nagam Avastitam. Tasmin Nagam Avastitam. Apashyat Kuvalaya Pidam. Apashyat Kuvalaya Pidam. Krishno Mbashta Prachoditam. Rangadwaram Samasadhya. Tasmin Nagam Avastitam. Apashyat Kuvalaya Pidam. Apashyat Kuvan, the gate. Samasadhya, reaching. Tasmin, in that place. Nagam, an elephant. Avastitam, standing. Apashyat, he saw. Kuvalaya Pidam, named Kuvalayapida. Krishna, Lord Krishna. Ambashta, by his keeper. Prachoditam, urged on. Translation. When Lord Krishna reached the entrance to the arena, he saw the elephant Kuvalayapida blocking his way at the urging of his keeper. Please repeat. When Lord Krishna reached the entrance to the arena, he saw the elephant Kuvalayapida blocking his way at the urging of his keeper. Purport. The elephant keeper revealed his malicious intent by blocking Lord Krishna's entrance into the arena. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Minitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Normally, there's a slightly longer purport from which to draw the class. If we stay truthful to the purport, then we have to talk about obstacles and we have to talk about Krishna's intent. And Krishna is Vigna Vinashana. Vigna means obstacles, Vinashana means removal of. So for everything that we wish to do, there is an obstacle. It is good to know about the obstacles before you embark on your activity. Then you won't be surprised when the obstacles come. Another Sanskrit word for obstacle is viruddha, plural virodhi. And in our Vaishnava life, we are very careful to understand what the obstacles might be to progress. We talked a little bit yesterday about how Prabhupada had them enunciate those obstacles to progress during the initiation ceremony. But it is not just during the initiation ceremony that we enunciate the irreligious principles. We have to enunciate them on a daily basis. We have to remember what they are and the details of them, and whether we are able to overcome them, because these are the things which will act as blocks to our healthy progress in spiritual life. Last night was also an opportunity. I was giving a talk about small groups development in the congregation, and a congregation of people is a group of people who've all taken an interest in pursuing a certain goal. Unless we know what is the obstacle to the individual in that spiritual intent and the obstacle to a group of individuals, then when the obstacles come, we'll be surprised. Often Prabhupada would say, do not be surprised who leaves, but be surprised who stays. In other words, when I hold an apple and I drop the apple doesn't go sideways, it doesn't go up, it doesn't spin, it doesn't go diagonally, it goes directly down. And if this happens, we're not surprised. The only people that are not surprised by an apple going downwards is a baby. And often you will see babies, they become very intrigued by gravity. It's something they've just become aware of. So they will take a spoon and they will drop it and they will watch it and laugh. And then the mother will come and put the spoon back. And then the baby will think, oh, this is fun. And she'll take the spoon and drop it again. And the baby will think, every time I drop the spoon, my mother comes running. My mother coming running is a good thing. Therefore, dropping the spoon must be a good thing. But eventually, the mother has to teach a higher lesson, that actually dropping the spoon is not a good thing, and making me run across the room to pick up the spoon, wash it, and put it back near your baby plate is also not a good thing. That's also when we get to our older years, we find that the laws of nature are very strong, very stringent. They don't let us go so easily. So therefore, at the beginning of any journey, just like I was coming here from London, and at the very beginning of the journey, the captain laid out the parameters of the journey. He said, we're going to be flying at a height of 37,000 feet. It was very windy on the way from Mauritius to London, so we may have a good tailwind from London to Mauritius. We may get there early. But for the last 3 hours of the journey, it's going to be bumpy. So this was his contract, so that no one got surprised when, at a certain point over Africa, the plane started getting very bumpy. He said that. We give a guru and disciple course in England now. It's actually obligatory. Everybody must come if they want to be initiated. Actually, we ask for people to subscribe to 4 or 5 extra conditions. We say that they must belong to a sangha. They must belong to a group of supportive friends, sangha. They must go there regularly. They must have a mentor or a senior devotee who can help them along the path when things become difficult. Because by these two things, by belonging to an anahata or a sangha and having a mentor, we hope to recreate the circumstances that Srila Prabhupada himself found necessary for someone to prosper in devotional life. Along with giving initiation, Prabhupada also initiated temples where we could live. They weren't just temples. Sometimes you go to India and you find that a temple is a very small building. It's a very small building. It's big enough for God, but it's not big enough for you to live in. So you go to the temple because that's God's place. It's not your place. You don't live there. But in medieval times, after Buddhism, it became important for, or early medieval times, it became important for Shankaracharya to live in a place with other sannyasis. And this would be often in a holy place, and they would be preaching there, so that all the pilgrims who came to that holy place, they would get the message, because his message was that Buddhism is an obstacle to self-realization. Buddhism is not true. It believes in extinction of the individual, whereas we, the Mayavadis, Shankarites, believe in the merging of the individual with Brahman. In fact, we believe that there is no individual at all. But we don't believe that there is nothing. We believe there is a divine substance, a higher substance known as Brahman, and that all individual souls have come from that Brahman, and to that original source we must return. So the sense of individuality, the sense of ego, is an obstacle, but not in the way that the Buddhists have taught, said Shankara. So in order to beat back Buddhism from India, he took over the holy places, and he went to the cardinal holy places where people had to go for pilgrimage. All the Hindus had to go for pilgrimage to Badri and Dwarka and Rameshwaram and Puri. And in this way, Shankaracharya hoped to beat back Buddhism, and he did, but by strength in numbers. So this was the beginning of a formal, you could say, city-based ashram system. Previously, if you want to practice spiritual life, you go and live in a forest or on a beach. Easy to practice spiritual life in Mauritius. There's enough beach to go around for every sadhu. So you go to the hills, you go by the bank of a river, you go to a mountain. These are the places where you practice spiritual life, not in the middle of a city where there's traffic all the time. Why would anyone practice spiritual life when it was where it was noisy? Well, the reason is, if your spiritual life was based upon giving out the message. So this dates back to Shankaracharya. And this was the beginning of what we know as the mutt system. So the mutt system is where you don't live in the guru's ashram in the forest, or in the guru's ashram on the mountaintop, or in the guru's ashram by the river where there are no people. You live in the guru's ashram where there are many, many people, because you want to speak to many, many people. You want to influence them. So you deliberately go where there are many, many people. In fact, you go to where there are most people. And of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came along, and his message was delivered where there are the most people, in the street, the shopping area, the marketplace, where people go to buy their vegetables. That's where you'll find the Harinam party. Anywhere people are shopping, that's where you find Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission in the West. The only converse reality of that was that Prabhupada said, but the householders should live in the country. They should have farms. Those who are preaching live in the cities, those who are on the farms with their children. And Prabhupada described a whole different way of life for those devotees. So his ISKCON movement was going to be based on this. Following on from the Gaudiya Mutt. So this Muttam, as they say in the south of India, Muttam or Mutt, is a place where two things are happening. One is that God lives, and God is giving access to you for darshan. And the other thing that's happening there is that not only the Saivites are living there, as how many Brahmins does it really take? Prabhupada said for Radhakrishna deities, he said 6 Brahmins. You see, minimum 6 Brahmins. Incidentally, this is why no ISKCON center should be known as a temple unless it has 6 Brahmins. In England, we had to say, you're not a temple, you're a preaching center, Prabhuji. You know, a temple has 6 Brahmins, minimum. So those 6 Brahmins, sometimes in India, we find that a temple has 4 Brahmins, or 3, or 2, or only 1. But a mat has many, usually young, usually single, brahmacharis, no brahmacharinis, living on the property for cultivation of sadhana bhakti. And these two things are there. So sometimes in ISKCON, when we say ISKCON temple, what we really mean is temple of the Lord plus Brahmacharya ashram plus vigorous preaching mission. That's what we say when we say ISKCON temple. But you see, some temples are not like, what we actually have is a mutt system. How did I get onto that subject? Stop me speaking if I drift. I'm not feeling too well today. So, that's right. So in order to remove obstacles on the path of devotional service, very quickly, Prabhupada said, live together. Live together. But Prabhupada also said that controlling your senses in this world is a very difficult thing to do. Living together with other people who are also controlling their senses, that's hard. Because when you control your senses, but you have unrestricted sense attachment, Rupa Goswami says, one is avirodha yukta krodhi. You're looking everywhere. The mind is looking everywhere for nice food. The men are looking for women. The women are looking for secure men. We're looking for property. We're looking for money. The mind is still looking for these things, but by Guru's order, we are restricted. And do you know what that produces? It produces avirodha yukta krodha. Avirodha yukta krodha means the anger that comes from restricted sense attachment. This is the thing. The anger that comes from restricted sense attachment. So that anger is a pollutant within the system. It's another virodhi, it's another obstacle. So when Krishna sees Kuvalyapida, this Kuvalyapida is an expression of the anger of the elephant keeper. And this anger is an expression of Kamsa's original fear. Of course, Krishna and Kuvalyapida, this is historical fact. There was a Kuvalyapida, there was a Krishna. It is not simply symbolic. But when analyzing these stories, sometimes Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he would take all the demons of Krishna Leela and he would say, what does this virodhi? Well, what virodhi does this represent? What obstacle in the path of bhakti does this represent? And it's slightly easier for me to talk about that. So these obstacles, what happens that when anger is within the system, it pollutes the system. It actually gets into the muscles. Did you know this? Anger actually is expressed as a hormone that gets into the muscles. And it must be discharged. It must be discharged. Just like if you drink a lot of water and you have a full bladder. Okay? Now you know what happens. It must be discharged. Has anyone ever been in a situation where you really wanted to pass water but you couldn't? Everybody's been in that situation. It drives you mad, doesn't it? Eventually you go anywhere. Anywhere. Hare Krishna. So anger is like that. Your body becomes filled with anger, and just like urine, which is also another pollutant, you must discharge it. You must get rid of it. And so therefore you do. And just like urine has to come out anywhere, eventually, anger comes out anywhere. It even comes out distressed relationships with devotees. It is expressed as an angry word or an angry thought. Now, offenses against the Vaishnavas begin with having an angry thought. Angry thought means that you objectify that other devotee as the obstacle in your life. In other words, everything was okay until you came along. And if I just remove you from my life, then everything will be all right. This is not, this does not make sense, actually. Because you're not the master of the universe. You may have noticed. When you put your tilak on this morning, did you see that you had four hands or two? Were you blue? No. Were you wearing a garland of lotus flowers? No. So therefore, you're not, take it from me, you're not the master of the universe. Therefore, who is or who is not sharing your mat or ashram with you? who is or who is not sharing this Krishna consciousness movement with you is not your business. It is Krishna's business, and Krishna has brought them. So therefore, we have to try to see Krishna's plan in everything rather than my plan. My plan is I want to be master of the universe, but I have a slight problem. I'm a member of ISKCON. And ISKCON is one organization which has a vowed intent that everybody makes a vow when they become initiated, or even when they just become interested, that I am not the master of the universe. In fact, I'm the servant of the master of the universe. More than that, I'm the servant of 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 the master of the universe. Well, that's a problem, isn't it? Because I still want money and women and a nice life and property. I still want these things. But I'm supposed to be the servant of the servant of the servant of everybody else. I don't like that. So that produces attention, and it produces frustration. And just like a slamming door, that comes out one day. So evil thinking, objectification of another devotee as the obstacle of your problem. You see, objectification means that you begin to think of the devotee not as he is, but as you are. You see, there's a nice story which I know you've heard, but I always like to tell the story, so I will tell it again. There was a British ship, just like now we are. I won't say we're celebrating, but in England, it is today or tomorrow is the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the Titanic. Everybody's heard of the name Titanic. If you haven't heard of the name of the Titanic, you may have heard of the movie, because the movie was very popular. Okay, so they're all having a wonderful time. But then they came to a virodhi. They came to an obstacle. The obstacle was an iceberg. The iceberg, who won? The Titanic lost. And so many lives were lost. So that was 100 years ago, either today or tomorrow. So in England, because Titanic was British and left from Southampton, where we have a Namahata, then we will be, everybody will be thinking, they will all be in Titanic consciousness today in England. So there was another British ship. And this British ship was going across the ocean. And it was a ship from the British Navy. And off in the distance it saw another ship. It saw the light off in the distance. And it said, oh, this ship is becoming too close. The captain said to the first mate, he said, can you please send a signal on the light that, you should move 3 degrees starboard. Otherwise, you might be getting too close to us. And we're a big ship, and our waves might make you rock. So they sent the message. You may send the message with a big light, and you open it, and it sends a light, it flashes, and when it closes, then there is no light. So they send it in Morse code. So he's sending. Then a sign came back. No, you move. And then the captain said, they don't understand who we are. He said, send this message immediately. He said, I am a ship of the Royal Navy. Send it back. He said, you move. The lamp came back, said, no, you move. So he says, what does this ship think that he's doing? Does he not know who I am? So he said, you send this message. I am an admiral of Her Majesty's Royal Navy. I command you to move. And then the light came back. It said, and I am a lighthouse, dear sir. So immediately, the captain, his consciousness, went from I am the master of the seas to I am the servant, you see. So we take from this, we take that there will be many such incidents in the life of ourselves as devotees, where we're suddenly going from being the master to being the servant. And practically when we live in the ashram, we have to be reminded every single day. That's why if you do live in the ashram, you make rapid Krishna consciousness. Not simply because of proximity to the deity, but because just every day there'll be an argument of some kind. Some kind. Whose Brahmin underwear is this? This is my string, and this is the place where I put my kulpins. Okay? I'm the master of this piece of string. You see, it holds on. So Ramanujacharya, he knew this. You know the story of Ramanujacharya. And he had sannyasis. And he had one householder disciple. And all the sannyasis were laughing at the householder disciple. Because, you know, his wife was pretty and she had jewelry and everything like that. So then one time Ramanuja said, well, you go to the house and you take the jewelry and see how he responds. So some people went to the house and they took the jewelry. And the wife's response was, you know, in the morning they went to Ramanuja and they said that, I may not be getting all the details of the story, but she said, some thieves came to our house last night. And Ramanuja, he smiled and he said, oh? He said, what was your reaction? She said, well, I just understand that, you know, I'm the servant of your servant's servant. And if I don't possess anything, everything belongs to Sri Hari. Therefore, I pretended to be asleep and I let them take the jewelry. And then I turned over and I was going to let them take the jewelry from the other side. My other earring, my other bangle. And but then they got scared thinking that I was waking up and they ran away. And eventually these sannyasis who had put up the thieves to this, they became very sheepish. But what had happened was in the night, Ramanuja had sent someone to cut their underwear in half, cut their kopin in half. And when they all came to their strings to see their Brahmin underwear all cut in half, there was panic in the ashram, you know, because sannyasis back in those days sannyasis didn't own very much. Okay, they didn't own very much. They just had their cloth and their bamboo sticks and maybe their water pot. And Prabhupada one time he said sometimes a sannyasi will become attached to his water pot, you see, or attached to maybe a few items of puja paraphernalia. But this is the extent that a sannyasi's attachment goes. Anyway, these sannyasis were attached to their underwear. And there was panic. And they came to Ramanuja and they said, someone has taken our underwear off the line. Someone has cut it in half with scissors. And Ramanuja was laughing. He said, just see. He said, you're laughing at the grihastas for being attached. You see. But actually, who is attached? You are more attached than them. Someone came in the night and took half of what you own, your underwear, and you become completely troubled. Someone in the night came and took half of what she owned, and she was going to give them the other half. So who is more attached? So normally, though, these are exceptional householders. And of course, when he passed away, he chose some of his householders and some of his sannyasis to be, if you like, his zonal acharyas, because he had a big zone. Ramanujacharya, it was half of India, so he chose 74 persons to be gurus and give initiation after him. And so the point here is that living in the ashram can bestow a great benediction, because kopin cutting incidents will happen quite often. Either it's, you know, I've been to different ashrams, ISKCON ashrams all over the world. Either you get your shoes taken by a visitor, or someone takes your bowl or cup. Or Srila Prabhupada went to Nairobi, and Prabhupada's laundry was drying on the line. And then his kurta was taken, his dhoti was taken, and various items were taken. And what happened was then the next morning, the brahmacharis, who were the guru's aspiring disciples, they came to Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam class wearing Prabhupada's kurta and Prabhupada's dhoti. So there is guru seva and guru druha. Druha means seva means that you express your gratitude to the devotee. Druha means guru druha means you express your ingratitude to the guru. You just want to keep taking and taking from the guru. Now, within ISKCON, unfortunately, the guru has become a relatively remote concept because we, again, are approaching a time when guru has thousands of disciples and very rarely gets to actually speak to them personally. Of course, Prabhupada had 4,800 disciples, and now some of our ISKCON gurus have more than that, many, many more than that. So then they're also approaching the point where sometimes they cannot visit the disciple or see the disciple. So the guru becomes a very remote figure. This is only a problem if you take the temple president out of the equation. The temple president in the old days was the person who managed the ashram. Actually, the temple president didn't do that. It was the temple commander. These days, unfortunately, the temple commander means the temple cleaner, isn't it? Temple commander is often relegated to the person who washes the pots or cleans the floor or something. Oh, he's the temple commander, he can clean the floor. No, temple commander is a person who commands you to clean the floor. That's temple commander. Why do you think he's called a commander? Commander in English is someone who tells you what to do. So if you live in the ashram, the temple commander is commanding you. We do not call him the temple polite asker or the temple humble requester. He's the temple commander. Prabhu, I would like you to clean up this floor now. Me, clean the floor, but I'm doing my sadhana. I'm doing my Bhagavatam study. How can I clean the floor? No, this is not ashram life. Ashram life is you're asked to clean the floor, you clean the floor, and you do it with gratitude. That my Guru Maharaj has given me permission to stay in the ashram. What a wonderful thing. I have permission to stay in the ashram, and I'm very grateful for that, because I'm making so much progress. It is so hard. It is so difficult. I could tell you stories of how difficult it was for me in the ashram, but I won't. But some devotees are determined not to make your life very easy. So there is a temple commander, and then there is the temple sadistic commandant who treats the temple like a concentration camp and treats you like his slave. This is not quite the right idea. Temple commander is meant to command with affection also, some love on behalf of the guru. Now here's the difficulty. In ISKCON, the temple commander's guru and my guru are two different people. In Prabhupada's time, the temple president's guru and my guru was exactly the same person. So when the temple president told me to do something, it was like it was coming from my guru. Today, the temple president's guru is one person. The temple commander's guru is another person. And then my guru is another person. So then most devotees think, why should I accept you as a representative of my guru here in this ashram, because your guru is the one I never wanted to become initiated by. You see? But you can't think like this. You can't think like this. You have to think, no. Actually, the guru of this ashram is the person who sits here. He sits here. Ultimately, he's the guru of the guru. He's the acharya. So when the temple president gives an order or the temple commander commands, that is gratefully received as an expression of Prabhupada's intent. That's the only way that it can work. And unfortunately, we would like it to be some other way, but Prabhupada himself backed up that system because it was his system. One time we had a devotee. Is this going on the internet? It is. Anyway, we had a devotee who challenged. The temple president at Bhaktivedanta Manor, who said that he's not doing this and he's not doing this. And so Prabhupada said, call for that devotee. Not the temple president, but the devotee who was complaining. And Prabhupada was very angry with him. And he pointed at him, he said, you do not criticize your temple president. Because Prabhupada knew that these men who are performing this function of being a temple president are the only men I have who've taken that responsibility. If I don't have them, if I have chaos in every temple, then the problem is that there will be chaos in every temple. There won't be a Hare Krishna movement. It won't move. So if you love your temple president, or even if you don't, do what they say. And if you don't love them and you find that you cannot do what you say, then you know the alternative. You see, there is an alternative. But I tell you one thing, that even in a building where you feel that the temple president or the temple commander or the person in charge, because you know what happens? When a temple president goes and another one takes the place, you will hate that person as well. And then when he goes and the next one comes, you'll hate that person as well. Why? Because that's the very viruddhi for your bhakti. Because your bhakti is, I want to be in that position. But you know, one day, everybody will be a temple president. Hopefully, in a few years, every single person sitting in this room will be either a temple president or the leader of an important sangha. What do you think, Prithvi? What do you think? You like that idea? Could you get used to that idea? In 1973, at Bhaktivedanta Manor in London, Prabhupada said that everyone must be a guru after him. Everyone must be guru. You see. On another occasion, he said, "I'm number such and such from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. My spiritual master was number such and such, and you are all number such and such. You see, 11, 12, 13, something like that." The whole point is that Prabhupada was, in a sense, describing a future to us where each and every devotee has to take responsibility for helping others in their spiritual life. You see? But when you're in the position, and let me tell you, it has happened to me several times, it will happen to you many times, it was when you're in the position of requesting or commanding or telling others what to do, giving instruction, and you feel that first wave of resistance, you'll realize, oh dear, this is something that I used to do to the person who told me what to do. You see, it is a cycle. So, I want to say here that we live in such a cycle, and the best way to deal with such a cycle is not to give way to the lower nature, but to aspire for one's higher nature. What is an emotional response, not a strategic response or political response, but what is a spiritual response? A spiritual response is somehow or another, I'm in this situation, and I'm feeling this great pressure on me. That I'm in a situation where, you know, I don't. You know, once I was in a situation where I just wasn't getting on with the temple president. It's the only time that has actually happened. But it was a very small center. And the temple president had come from corporate life. He'd come from 14 years being the manager of a factory, having everybody under him in a paid salaried position. So you know, when you're the manager of an organization, You can just say, do this, do this, do this, and because they're receiving a wage, they have to do it, or else. So he came into ISKCON with that mentality, and unfortunately, he was my junior, but he was in the hierarchy, he was my senior. So hierarchy means that he's senior, and I've, you know, so I really did for many, many months, and then it got to a point where I couldn't do it. So I didn't get angry. There's the two responses. Some people get angry and they challenge, and some people just walk away. Now, many people come to our ISKCON movement and they get angry, you see, and we have to take the anger as the most favorable option, actually, because the least favorable option is they just drift away and you never see them again, either at the temple or at the Namhata group. Something's happened. People cannot express their anger with religious people, but they just drift away. So better to have a person be very frank and honest and sometimes angry, and to be able to deal with that. So anyway, I was the drifting away kind, and I caught the bus. And just before I caught the bus, with all my... I didn't even have a bag. I was a brahmachari. I didn't even have a bag to put my things in. So I had a cardboard box. So I was sitting on the bus, looking very miserable, with my cardboard box, with my two dhotis, you know, and my bead bag, and a few bits of soap, maybe. So my cardboard box. And I was going to take the bus to another place in Africa. And somehow or another, he understood what was happening, and he came onto the bus. And then he tried very hard to persuade me to stay, but it was too late. Was too late. Now, there was only four devotees living in the temple, so that was a quarter of his manpower gone that day. So that was his hard lesson. My hard lesson was that I have to learn to speak up, and I have to learn to engage in polite negotiation, you see, because sometimes people don't understand that they're causing difficulty in your life. So you have to say, Prabhuji, you know, what you said yesterday, after you said it, I felt very bad with myself. And I just wondered, can we please talk about this? You see, that's better than silence. And it's better than saying, you know, you came to me yesterday and you did this and you did this and you did this and you made me feel, you know, it's all about, you know, my feelings and not about you. Well, I know that in many parts of our movement, this has become a focal point of preaching, because a part of our preaching to the devotees is a stability for our society. Because ultimately, these are all things that Prabhupada had to talk about as well. If you go through Prabhupada's letters, you will find that there was basic preaching, different principles. There was asking questions. There was practical management. And there was keeping the peace. Keeping the peace. If you go through the letters of St. Paul, St. Paul's letters make up the bulk of the New Testament. And St. Paul's letters are to different Namahata groups, you could say, in different towns. There was a group group that he'd started. So Paul would go to a place, he would preach about Jesus Christ. They would form some, you know, form a group of people who would come together regularly to sing songs and talk about the philosophy, you know. So St. Paul was actually a Namahata preacher. And the New Testament is made up of his letters to these different groups. And it's interesting to read the letters. I'm not advising anyone here to read the Bible, but if you want to see what he had to do, it's sometimes interesting. So there was a place called Rome. Rome is in Italy. And there was a group. Then there was a place called Ephesus. Then there was a place called Corinth. And so his letters to Rome, to his devotees in Rome, becomes the Romans. And that's one book of the New Testament. To Corinth, it becomes Corinthians. The letters to the people of Corinth. And letters to people in Ephesus becomes Ephesians. So really, The Bible is not so much made up of Jesus' words. In fact, if you take all of Jesus' actual words, what you get is 23 pages of a small book. 23 pages. It's not very much at all. One of the one of the presidents of the United States of America, Thomas Jefferson, he made up a new Testament by cutting out with a razor blade everything that Jesus actually said. That this week, Thomas Jefferson's Bible is on display in Washington. And it's a Bible with pieces cut out. It's only what Jesus said has been cut out. So the rest of the Bible is Paul. Or a great predominance of it is Paul's letters. Because as soon as you have the preacher who starts God consciousness in a particular town, that must be followed up by a leading devotee who deals with the conflict that comes. They're always there. So in Prabhupada's letters was always stressing, just be humble, be patient, be tolerant. There's no such thing as utopia. You know, ISKCON is not utopia. Do not argue with each other. Do not fight. You know, neophyte means neophyte. You know, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, one time he came into a... is it time to finish? Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, Srila Prabhupada's guru, came into a room one time, and he was standing in the door, and there was two sannyasis arguing, very angry at each other. And he was just watching them. And then immediately they saw him, they paid obeisances, and they said, Guru Maharaj, we're so sorry to argue in front of you. And he said, no, it is my fault. He said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took kings, maharajas, and he made them into beggars, meaning Maharaj Pratap Rudra. And he said, but I have taken beggars, and I've turned them into maharajas. And when I take beggars and turn them into maharajas, they fight. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took maharajas and he made them into beggars. He said, so this is my fault for doing this. And you see, this tendency to fight, this was there when Bhaktisiddhanta was on the planet. He only had 18 sannyasis, so I understand. Many thousands of disciples. Although the figure of his disciples is hotly contested, actually, in some quarters. And they were fighting during his presence in the world, and they were fighting afterwards. And ultimately the fight became so great that instead of the one Gaudiya Math movement, we had the many Gaudiya Math movements. And that is why all along Bhaktisiddhanta Road is the many different headquarters of the different movements. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati built the road, and he built one movement. But the followers built many headquarters. So the decoration of Bhaktisiddhanta Road is an unfortunate decoration. It is not a nice decoration. So our Srila Prabhupada, his greatest hope, or his greatest fear, he said, my greatest fear, he says, I'm always afraid of this crack. Always afraid of this crack. That the movement would split and become two movements, three movements, four movements, five movements. And therefore, one of the greatest principles in ISKCON that you will find, but it is the thing that you cannot find in Shastra. You will not find this in any Shastra, anywhere. Not in the Vedas, not in the Upapuranas, not in the Puranas, not in the Upanishads, not in the Bhagavatam, not in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. You will not find this one principle that Prabhupada talked about. And that is unity in diversity. You'll find the spiritual essence of it. You'll find that peace is such an important part of spiritual relationships with other Vaishnavas. But you won't find anything about a united organization with many gurus and many shishas. Because it didn't exist in ancient times. As soon as you became a guru and your shishas were yours, you set up your ashram, you had your mat, and this was the way it happened. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati changed that. And Prabhupada has changed that. And the idea is by a united preaching mission, we can all accomplish more. That was Prabhupada's hopes for ISKCON. Now, there were many, many new preaching centers in Prabhupada's time, sometimes because he sent them. Prabhupada would sometimes say to people, all right, he would say, Giridhariam Karunika, you have been traveling on this train with me, now you can get off the train and you can start a center. Or he would say, Giridhariam Karunika, you've been here in Mauritius a long time. I'm not saying this is what Prabhupada would say. He said, but we need another center in Hong Kong. And then the devotees would go to Hong Kong. They'd never been to Hong Kong. They didn't speak the language. But Prabhupada would send them. And this sending out of devotees is something that Prabhupada was very, you know, particular on. Sometimes Prabhupada wouldn't send them. They'd just leave because they couldn't get on with their local temple president. So, someone couldn't get on in Los Angeles, so they went up to Montreal. Someone couldn't get on with that temple president in Montreal, so they went to Ottawa. And then someone couldn't get on with that person, so they went over to Calgary or something. So some centers were started like that. But, you know, ultimately each of us must get to a point where we're almost driven mad by not being able to deal with the devotees around us. I think everybody reaches that point of madness when there's no, you know, and madness can come quickly on a small island because there's not that many places to go. You can always go to the Seychelles or, Madagascar's there, you see. But there's not too many places to go where the concentration of population is such that you could survive as a president of your own temple. In America, they have a very interesting system. You go to Bible college for 5 or 6 years, you really learn the Bible, and you want to become a pastor, you want to become a preacher. And then you go to this company, and this company serves pastors by doing everything for you. They will locate for you a town where you can set up, where the Christian ministry is not so developed. Then they'll help you with a loan for a church. Then they will help you to identify the right type of message for you, for the right type of people that you want. They'll find the people for you. They'll work out bus routes and how much it's all going to cost. They'll add up what it's going to take to pay for you as the temple president, how big the building should be, how many people you can expect to have, how much each person should pay so that the temple president is paid for by the congregation, and subtract the cost of the buses that you will lay on to bring the people to your church. And that's part of a financial package. So then all the pastor has to do, he has to say that Jesus wants you to give now. So he gives the message, and then he pays his loan back to this company. Now, we don't have such a company that we can go to, but the point is that we would like it if it was. But sometimes we actually need that. In 1973, there was a problem at Bhaktivedanta Manor because bailiffs were coming and they were taking away our chandeliers. We had no money. When Prabhupada first came to Bhaktivedanta Manor and he looked at the big building, he said, oh, now you have your white elephant. White elephant, an albino elephant, you give to the king that you don't like. Because they are weak. They can't do very much. They can't lift things. They can't pull things. They can't push things. They're very weak, white elephants. But they eat just as much as an ordinary elephant. So an elephant that eats but doesn't do any work only costs money. So it is a gift. It is a gift, but it ends up costing you a lot of money. So when Prabhupada saw the big white house of Bhaktivedanta Manor, he said, oh, so now you've got your big white elephant. It was George Harrison's idea to get a big house in the country with 17 acres. Previously, one of George Harrison's friends, a man called Peter Sellers, he was a famous actor, a very famous actor in the 1960s, he got friendly with the devotees, and he said, look, I have a farm, and I'd like to give you a farm. And you know what the devotees said? They said, no, we don't do farming. You see, so that might have been what Prabhupada actually wanted was a farm. But he had a big country house, which is what George Harrison wanted to give us. He said every organization has to have a prestigious house with lots of space and big parkland. But it was only 17 acres. You can't do a lot of farming with 17 acres. Now we're 75 acres. You can do a little more farming, but you still need 300, 400, 500 acres to maintain a community. It turned out that we had a big house, but we didn't have enough money for it. And they told Prabhupada and said, he said, so how many Indians are there in the UK? And they said, about 100,000, Prabhupada. Now there's 1 million. But it's about 100,000, Prabhupada. He said, so if each of them gives you £1 every month, is that enough money to look after the temple? They said, yes. It was more than five times enough to look after the temple in those days. So he said, so you can do that. So that began one of our programs of, you know, temple support. But you also have to be careful that a temple does not become just fat. You know, it's never good to become fat. Temple should be slim and trim. You know, shouldn't become corpulent. So financially, what we, and strategically, spiritually, what we need is as many temples as possible and as many towns as there are. Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, my name will be heard in every town and every village. So for Mauritius, that actually means every town and every village. But if it's not a building, then at least has to be a place where people come together and they chant the name of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That means Sri Krishna, Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasa Hari Gaura Bhaktivinoda. And Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hari Hari, Hari Rama, Rama Rama, Hari Hari. And they will only do that, firstly, if they're friends. Secondly, if there's a person who is the most enthusiastic, who will guide them. And third, if you at least give them something to eat. I see. You can give them a meal before, or you can give them a meal afterwards. Sometimes a meal before works better. You see, if you wait for them to go home and have a meal, and then come, they come at 8:30. And then the Sangha program, the Namahata program, doesn't develop because it's always too late at night. And our preachers, they don't like staying up late at night. Especially our brahmacharis, they don't like staying up late at night. They like getting up early. So the point here is that if people can be convinced to have our programs, our kirtan and discussion programs, a little earlier, then that's good. So I'm hopeful that on an island, you can do it. Because in England, everyone has to, in London, for instance, everyone has to commute, you know, at least an hour. To get from their house to the place where they work is at least 1 hour. Sometimes people are commuting 120 miles on the train per day, and then 120 miles back in the evening. And then they want to become Krishna conscious. There's just no time left. There really is no time. But at least hopefully you have that time. So anyway, we talk more tonight about these things. But I just thought that I would gently work this into class, because this is my theme for the week. But there will always be problems. But if you treat the problem as an opportunity and think, this person is standing in front of me and they're very angry, how can I treat this as an opportunity for my spiritual growth? How can I grow from this? And then the person's, you know, you're becoming very angry at a person. Often I find with myself that I become angry at a person who's speaking the truth about me. Because I'm proud, okay, and a person is speaking the truth about me, and I'm thinking, I don't like this. You're telling me the truth. You're telling me things that are real, and I find that hard to deal with, you see. And sometimes people become angry at me and they're not telling the truth. So I have to be detached enough in order to discern, is this person telling me some truth, you know? And just like one man, he was very angry with a particular preacher. This was, many years ago. He was very angry with a particular preacher. And he came to a friend of the preacher and he said, you know this person, he does this, he does that, he says this, he says that. And the man stood up and he said, you cannot say that about this man. That man has given his life to preaching. You cannot speak like that about him. He became very angry back. And then the man even became more angrier. And he said, well, what about you? You're like this, you're like that, you're like this, you're like that. And the man said, yes, thank you. Every word you've spoken is true. And now, if you don't mind, I have to be with God, and I have to pray to God, and I have to think about how I can correct myself. Thank you so much for giving me that information. So exactly the same thing as he said about his friend, the preacher, who he'd vigorously defended. When it came to him, he said, it was a Christian preacher. He said, so now you have to give me some space now. I need to pray about this. I need to see how I can deal with this in my life. So I just want to say that there's different spiritual responses that you can give. And sometimes we have people who concoct stories, don't they? Like sometimes we have Rath Yatra, and in England we have a group of people and they're giving out magazines, you know, how to go back to Prabhupada. In England, we're going to print another magazine, and it's called Turn Your Back to Prabhupada. This is what the magazine is, Turning Their Back to Prabhupada. Because Prabhupada stands for humility, respect, gratitude, Vaishnav Seva. These are all the qualities that Prabhupada... So if you want to go back to Prabhupada, be humble, be grateful, be respectful, do Vaishnava Seva. But they give out their magazine, and they become very, very angry. And they become very, very angry at me. And every time they become angry at me, I have to treat it seriously because it might be true. But then when I reflect about it, I think, no, no. And it took me a long time to understand, no, these are just envious people. Actually, just envious people. They're just people who don't have Vaishnava culture. They don't have Vaishnava achar. This anger, they think is the Krodha is the Krodha Bhushana. They think anger is their ornament. You see. That just as Prabhupada sometimes became angry at the scientists and the education system and the politicians and this one and that one, Prabhupada would become angry at all different types of people. And sometimes people can't understand Prabhupada's anger was for a particular purpose on behalf of Krishna. So then they get angry at the devotees of Krishna and think, yes, we are angry on behalf of Prabhupada. We are Prabhupada Anugas. You see. Well, it takes more than just putting Anuga on the end of your name to be a follower of Prabhupada. You want to be a follower of Prabhupada? I tell you what you do. You come and live in a temple. You get up at 3:30 in the morning. You clean the floor when someone tells you to clean the floor. You do as you're told. You eat what everybody else eats. You go out on Sankirtan and you sell books in the street to people who don't want to buy books. And when you do these things, and you go on Harinam in the sunshine, when you do these things, then you will be Prabhupada Anuga. You'll be following Prabhupada because this is the way of life that Prabhupada taught us. You see. Not when the Rath Yatra party goes by to stand there and shout at the, you know, you let the Christians do that. In America, that's what the Christians do. They walk in front of they walk at the very front of the, you know, like thousands and thousands of devotees. They walk and they're in a line with their banners. You know, it's funny. There's the Jagannath cart. There's all these thousands of devotees doing kirtan, and at the front is the Christians, and they're with their placards, and it says "Turn or burn." Or it says, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. So now it's been going on for so many years now that when people see the Los Angeles Rath Yatra, they always expect to see the Christians at the front. But do you know what the devotees do? They just carry on having a blissful kirtan. You see? When you're doing a fire yajna, you take a pinch. You take a pinch of soil and you throw it to the side. You purify the fire yajna by throwing out the elements that are there. And you say, Om Nirasta Paravasu. And you throw it to the northeast. Om Nirasta Paravasu. You get rid of those things. So it is considered that there will, when the yajna is taking place, there will always be some inauspicious item there. You see, there will always be some resistance. And Prabhupada thrived on that resistance. In fact, that resistance gave him more life. You see. And there will always be some resistance to our preaching. But it's how we respond that determines whether we are a political movement or a spiritual movement. Spiritual, we have to be driven inwards and find greater levels of spirituality, and that will govern our response. And if we can find greater love in our heart to respond to those, even those who are very angry at us, then this is always a good principle. It was a good principle for St. Paul. It was a good principle for Srila Prabhupada. It's a good principle for our different leaders. These are the responses that we have to come. Even at the risk of, you know, going mad with self-doubt, you know, but this is called for. We always have to think, how can I use this position of resistance or this obstacle in my path in order to achieve a greater purpose for Krishna? You see. And of course, this is what Krishna does. Krishna's purpose is to remove Kamsa. So then his purpose is to remove all the obstacles on the path of Kamsa. Sacrificial bow, Kuvalayapida, they're all removed. All the Virodhi is removed on the way to Kamsa. Ramanujacharya says it is equally important in spiritual life to know the obstacles to spiritual life than it is to know what actual spiritual life is. And as devotees, sometimes we don't talk about the obstacles sufficiently. That's why last night we spent a good half hour where all the members of the different groups came and they spoke about obstacles on the path of devotion. Because unless you know what they are, you won't know how to deal with them, and you'll be very surprised when they happen to you. But believe me, they happen to everyone. So everyone has to deal with them at some stage. So Krishna deals with Kuvalyapida, and we are Krishna's servants. We are dealing with various obstacles to the path of progress of this Krishna consciousness movement. We have to deal very cleverly. Sometimes Krishna uses the very strength of an individual to defeat the individual. So when Krishna deals with Kuvalyapida, the strength of the individual is his tusks. So Krishna goes for the tusks, and he uses the forward movement of the elephant, and he pulls the tusks forward. Krishna does Aikido. You know, he pulls the elephant forward. You see, the elephant is charging. He pulls him with his tusk, and then he swings using the tusk. You see, or Kaliya. Kaliya is like this. Kaliya serpent, and Krishna dances on the heads of Kaliya. Keshi has a big mouth. That wasn't a very good horse impression, was it? And Krishna uses the mouth. He puts his fist into the mouth. Aristasura, he uses the horns. So whatever is thrown at Krishna, Krishna uses the strength of that individual to be his weakness. You see. So in a similar way, we have to use everything that's, how can I use this to my advantage now? How can I use this to my advantage? Individually, and individually for the prosperity of Srila Prabhupada's movement. And you will find that that gives energy. We don't have to do anything but use the energy that comes to us in a particular way. It's kind of like an ISKCON Aikido. you know, whatever they throw at you, you know, as people say, when life throws you a lemon, make lemonade. Don't go, oh, it's a lemon. No, make some lemonade. You add something to it. You add some sugar to it. Your business is to add sugar. Their business is to throw a lemon at you, but your business is to add sugar and make a pleasant drink. So, Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. I think we should have questions another time. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Granth Raj, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.